Running an online business is hard enough without the stress and time consumption of managing hosting. Whether managing one WordPress site or dozens, Kinsta's managed solutions offer speed, enterprise-grade security, and an intuitive dashboard. With 24/7, 365 human-only expert support, get peace of mind that your sites stay online, secure, and performing their best. Start today and get your first month free with migrations handled for you. Learn more at kinsta.com/podcast. That's kinsta.com/podcast.
Chapter 28 of At the Time Appointed. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Amy Graymore. At the Time Appointed by A. Maynard Barber. Chapter 28. As a Dream When One Awaketh. As the morning sun arose over the snowy summits of the Great Divide, the sleeper on the rock stirred restlessly, then gradually awoke to consciousness. A delightful consciousness of renewed life and vigor, a subtle sense of revivification of body and mind. The racking pain, the burning fever, the legions of torturing phantoms all were gone. His pulse was calm, his blood cool, his brain clear. With a sigh of deep content he opened his eyes, then suddenly rose to a sitting posture and gazed about him in utter bewilderment. Above him only the boundless dome of heaven, around him only endless mountain ranges. Dazed by the strangeness, the isolation of the scene, he began for an instant to doubt his sanity. Was this a reality or a chimera of his own imagination? But only for an instant, for with his first movement a large collie had bounded to his side and now began licking his hands and face with the most joyful demonstrations. There was something soothing and reassuring in the companionship even of the dumb brute, and he caressed the noble creature, confident that he would soon find some sign of human life in that strange region. But the dog, reading no look of recognition in the face beside him, drew back and began whining piteously. Perplexed, but with his faculties thoroughly aroused and active, the young man sprang to his feet, and looking eagerly about him, discovered at a little distance the cabin against the mountain ledge. Hastening thither, he found the door open, and after vainly waiting for any response to his knocking, entered. The furnishings were mostly handmade, but fashioned with considerable artistic skill, and contributed to give the interior a most attractive appearance, while etchings, books, and papers, pages of written manuscript, and a violin indicated its occupants to be a man of refined tastes and studious habits. The dog had accompanied him, sometimes following closely, sometimes going on in advance as though to lead the way. Once within the cabin, he led him to the storeroom in the rock where was an abundance of food, which the latter proceeded to divide between himself and his dumb guide. Having satisfied his hunger, the young man took a newspaper from the table, and going outside the cabin, seated himself to await the return of his unknown host. Sitting there, he discovered for the first time the railway winding around the sides of the lofty mountain opposite. The sight filled him with delight, for those slender rails, gleaming in the morning sunlight, seemed to connect him with the world which he remembered, but from which he appeared so strangely isolated. Unfolding the newspaper, his attention was attracted by the date, at which he gazed in consternation, his eyes riveted to the page. For a moment his head swam. He was unable to believe his own senses. Dropping the sheet, and bowing his head upon his hands, he went carefully over the past as he now remembered it. The business on which he had been commissioned to come west. His journey westward. The tragedy in the sleeping car. He shuddered as the memory of the murderer's face flashed before him with terrible distinctness. His reception at the Pines. All was as clear as though it had happened but yesterday. It was in August, and this was August, but 2 years later. Great God, had 2 years dropped out of his life? Again he recalled his illness, the long agony, the final sinking into oblivion, the strange awakening in perfect health. Yes, surely there must be a missing link, but how? Where? He rose to re-enter the cabin, and passing the window caught a glimpse of his face reflected there, a face like and yet unlike his own, and crowned with snow-white hair. In doubt and bewilderment he paced up and down within the cabin, vainly striving to connect these fragmentary parts, to reconcile the present with the past. As he passed and repassed the table, covered with manuscript, his attention was attracted by an odd-looking volume bound in flexible morocco, and containing several hundred pages of written matter. It lay partly open in a conspicuous place, and upon the fly-leaf was written, in large, bold characters, "To my other self should he awaken." He could not banish the words from his mind. They drew him with irresistible magnetism. Again and again he read them. until, impelled by some power he could not explain, he seized the volume, and seating himself in the doorway of the cabin, proceeded to examine it. Lifting the fly-leaf, he read the following inscription: "To one from the outer world, whose identity is hidden among the secrets of the past, with the hope that when the veil is lifted, these pages may assist him in uniting into one perfect whole the strangely disjointed portions of his life. They are inscribed by John Darrell." He smiled as he read the name, and recalled the circumstances under which he had taken it. But he no longer felt any hesitation regarding the volume in his hands, and he began to read. It was written as communication from one stranger to another, from the mountain recluse to one whose life he had not the slightest knowledge. But he knew without a doubt that it was addressed to himself, yet written by himself, that writer and reader were one and the same. For more than 2 hours he read on and on, deeply absorbed in the tale of that solitary life, his own heart responding to each note of joy or sorrow, of hope or despair, and vibrating to the undertone of loneliness and longing running through it all. He strove vainly to recall the characters in the strange drama in which he had played his part, but of which he had now no distinct recollection. Dimly they passed before his vision like the shadowy phantoms of a dream from which one has just awakened. He started at the first mention of John Britton's name, eagerly following each outline of that noble character, his heart kindling with affection as he read his words of loving, helpful counsel. His face grew tender and his eyes filled at the love story, so pathetically brief, faithfully transcribed on those pages. But of Kate Underwood he could only recall a slender girl with golden brown hair and wistful, appealing brown eyes. He wondered at the strength of character shown by her speech and conduct, and his heart went out to this unknown love, notwithstanding that memory now showed him the picture of another, an earlier love in the Far East. But it was the story of John Britton's life which moved him most. With strained, eager eyes and bated breath, he read that sad recital, and at its termination buried his face in his hands and sobbed like a child. When he had grown calm, he sat for some time reviewing the past and forming plans for future action. While thus absorbed in thought, he heard a step, and looking up saw standing before him a man of apparently 60 years, with bronzed face and grizzled hair, whose small, piercing eyes regarded him with keen scrutiny. In response to the younger man's greeting, he only bowed silently. "You must be Peter the Hermit," the young man exclaimed. "But whoever you are welcome. I'm glad to see a human face." "And you," replied the other slowly, "you are not the same man that you were yesterday. You have awakened, as he said you would some day." "As who said?" the other man questioned. "John Britton," the other replied. "Yes, I have awakened, and my life here is like a dream. Sit down, Peter. I want to ask you some questions." For half an hour they sat together, the younger man asking questions, the other answering in as few words as possible, his keen eyes never leaving the face of his interlocutor. "Where is this John Britton?" the young man finally inquired. "In Ophir, at a place called The Pines." "I know the place. I remember it. How far is it from here?"
15 miles by rail from the station at the foot of the mountain."
"I must go to him at once. You will show me the way? How soon can we get away from here?"
Peter glanced at the sun.
"We cannot get down the trail in season for today's train. We will start tomorrow morning."
Without further speech, he went into the cabin and busied himself with his accustomed duties. When he reappeared, he again stood silently regarding the younger man with his fixed, penetrating gaze.
"What awakened you?" he asked at length.
The abruptness of the question, as well as its tenor, startled the other. That was a phase of the mystery surrounding himself, of which he had not even thought.
"I don't know," he replied slowly. "That question had not occurred to me before. What do you think? Might it not have come about in the ordinary sequence of events?"
Peter shook his head. "Not likely," he muttered. "There must have been a shock of some kind." The young man smiled brightly. "Well, I cannot answer for yesterday's events," he said, "having neither record nor recollection of the day. But I certainly sustained a shock this morning on awakening on the bare rocks at such an altitude as this, and with no trace of a human being visible."
"On the rocks?" Peter repeated. "Where?"
"Yonder," said the young man, indicating the direction. "Come, I'll show you the exact spot." He led the way to his rocky bed, near one end of the plateau, then watched his companion's movements as he knelt down and carefully inspected the rock, then, rising to his feet, looked searchingly in every direction with his ferret-like glance.
"Ah!" the latter suddenly exclaimed, with emphasis, at the same time pointing to a rock almost overhanging their heads.
Following the direction indicated, the young man saw a pine tree on the edge of the overhanging rock, the entire length of its trunk split open, its branches shriveled and blackened as though by fire. Peter, notwithstanding his age, sprang up the rocks with the agility of a panther, the younger man following more slowly. As he came up, Peter turned from an examination of the dead tree, and looked at him significantly. "An electric shock," he said. "That was a living tree yesterday. There was an electric storm last night, the worst in years. It brought death to this tree, but life to you." To the younger man the words of the old hermit seemed incredible, but that night brought him a strange confirmation of their truth. Upon disrobing for the night, what was his astonishment to discover upon his right shoulder, and extending downward, diagonally across the right breast, a long blue mark of a regular zigzag form, while running parallel with its entire length, perfect as though done in India ink with an artist's pen, was the outline of the very scene surrounding him where he lay that morning. Cliff and crag and mountain peak, traced indelibly upon the living flesh, an indubitable experience of the power which had finally aroused his dormant faculties, and a souvenir of the lost years which he would carry with him to his dying day. End of chapter 28.
Chapter 29 of At the Time Appointed. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Jules Harlech, Mississauga, Ontario, Canada. At the Time Appointed by A. Maynard Barbour. Chapter 29. John Darrell's Story. On the following morning, the cabin on the mountainside was closed at an early hour, and its late occupant, accompanied by Peter and the collie, descended the trail to the small station near the base of the mountain, where he took leave of the old hermit. On his arrival at Ophir, he ordered a carriage and drove directly to the pines, for he was impatient to see John Britton at as early a date as possible, and was fearful lest the latter, with his migratory habits, might escape him. It was near noon when, having dismissed the carriage, he rang for admission. He recalled the house and grounds as they appeared to him on his first arrival, but he found it hard to realize that he was looking upon the scenes among which most of that strange drama of the last 2 years had been enacted. Mr. Underwood himself came to the door. "Why, Darrell, my boy, how do you do?" he exclaimed, shaking hands heartily. "Thought you'd take us by surprise, eh? Got a little tired of living alone, I guess, and thought you'd come back to your friends. Well, that's mighty good to see you. Come in. We'll have lunch in about an hour." To Mr. Underwood's surprise, the young man did not immediately accept the invitation to come in, but seemed to hesitate for a moment. "I'm very glad to meet you, Mr. Underwood," he responded pleasantly, but with a shade of reserve in his manner. "I remember you very well indeed, and probably yours is about the only face I will be able to recall." For a moment, Mr. Underwood seemed staggered, unable to comprehend the meaning of the other's words. The young man continued, "I understand Mr. Britton is stopping with you. Is he still here, or has he left?" "He is here," Mr. Underwood replied. "But good God, Darrell, what does this mean?" Before the other could reply, Mr. Britton, who was in the adjoining room and had overheard the colloquy, came quickly forward. He gave a swift, penetrating glance into the young man's face, then, turning to Mr. Underwood, said, "It means, David, that our young friend has come to his own again. He is no longer of our world or of us." Then turning to the young man, he said, "I am John Britton. Do you wish to see me?" The other looked earnestly into the face of the speaker, and his own features betrayed emotions as he replied, "I do. I must see you on especially important business." "David, you will let us have the use of your private room for a while?" Mr. Britton inquired. Mr. Underwood nodded silently, his eyes fixed with a troubled expression upon the young man's face. The latter, observing his distress, said, "Don't think, Mr. Underwood, that I am insensitive to all your kindness to me since my coming here 2 years ago. I shall see you later and show you that I am not lacking in appreciation, though I can never express my gratitude to you. But before I can do that, before I can even tell you who I am, it is necessary that I see Mr. Britton." "Tut, tut," said Mr. Underwood gruffly. "Don't talk to me of gratitude. I don't want any. But my God, boy, I had come to look on you almost as my own son." And, turning abruptly, he left the room before either of the others could speak. "He is a man of very strong feelings," said Mr. Britton, leading the way to Mr. Underwood's room. "And to tell the truth, this is the pretty hard blow to each of us, although we should have prepared ourselves for it. Be seated, my son." Seating himself beside the young man and again looking into his face, he said, "I see that the day has dawned. When did the light come, and how?" Briefly, the other related his awakening on the rocks and events which followed down to his finding and reading the journal which recorded so faithfully the history of the missing years, Mr. Britton listening with intense interest. At last the young man said, "Of all the records of that journal, there was nothing that interested me so greatly or moved me so deeply as did the story of your own life. That is what brought me here today. I have come to tell you my story, the story of John Darrell as you have known him, and possibly you may find it in some ways a counterpart to your own. I was drawn towards you in some inexplicable way for our first meeting," Mr. Britton replied slowly. "You became as dear to me as a son, so that I gave you in confidence the story that no other human being has ever heard. It is needless to say that I appreciate this mark of your confidence in return, and that you can rest assured of my deepest interest in anything concerning yourself." The younger man drew his chair nearer his companion. "As you already know," he said, "I am a mine expert. I came out here on a commission for a large eastern syndicate, and as there was likely to be lively competition and I wished to remain incognito, I took the name of John Darrell, which in reality was a part of my own name. My home is in New York State. I was a country-bred boy, brought up on one of those great farms which abound a little north of Central Park of the state. But, though country-bred, I was not a rustic, for my mother, who was my principal instructor until I was about 14 years of age, was a woman of refinement and culture. My mother and I lived at her father's house, a beautiful country home, but even while a mere child, I became aware that there was some kind of unpleasant secret in our family. My grandfather would never allow my father's name mentioned, and he had little love for me as his child. But my earliest recollections of my mother are of her kneeling with me night after night in prayer, teaching me to love and revere the father I had never known, who, she told me, was gone away, and to pray always for his welfare and for his return. At 14, I was sent away to a preparatory school and afterwards to college. Then, as I developed a taste for mineralogy and metallurgy, I took a course in the Columbian School of Mines. By this time I had learned that while it was generally supposed my mother was a widow, there were those, my grandfather among them, who believed that my father had deserted her. My first intimation of this was an insinuation to that effect by my grandfather himself, soon after my graduation. I was an athlete and already had a good position at a fair salary, and so great was my love and reverence for my father's name that I told the old gentleman that nothing but his white hair saved him from a sound thrashing, and that at first repetition of any such insinuation, I would take my mother from under his roof and provide a home for her myself. That sufficed to silence him effectively, for he idolized her. After this little episode, I went to my mother and begged her to tell me the secret regarding my father. The young man paused for a moment, his dark eyes gazing earnestly into the clear gray eyes, watching him intently. Then, without shifting his gaze, he continued in slow tones. She told me that about a year before my birth, she and my father were married against her father's will, his only objections to the marriage being that my father was poor. She told me of their happy married life that followed, but that my father was ambitious, and the consciousness of poverty and the fact that he could not provide for her as he wished galled him. She told me how, when there was revealed to them the promise of a new love and life within their little home, he redoubled his efforts to do for her and hers, and then, dissatisfied with what he could accomplish there, went out into the new West to build a home for his little family. She told of the brave, loving letters that came so faithfully and the generous remittances to provide for every possible need in the coming emergency. Then fortune beckoned him still farther west, and he obeyed, daring the dangers of that strange, wild country for the love he bore his wife and his unborn child. From that country only one letter ever was received from him. Just at that time I was born, and my life came near costing hers who bore me. For weeks she lay between life and death, so low that the report of her death reached her parents, bringing them broken-hearted, and, as they supposed, too late to her humble home. They found her yet living, and threw their love and their wealth into the battle against death. In all this time no news came from the great West. As soon as she could be moved, my mother and her child were taken to her father's home. Her father forgave her, but he had no forgiveness for her husband and no love for his child. He tried to make my mother believe her husband had deserted her, but she was loyal in her trust in him as in her love for him. She named her child for her father, John. But as her father would not allow the name repeated in his hearing, she gave him the additional name of Darrell, by which he was universally known. But in those sacred hours when she told me of my father and taught me to pray for him, she always called me by his name, John Britton. As he ceased speaking, both men rose simultaneously to their feet. The elder man placed his hands upon the shoulders of the younger, and, standing thus face to face, they looked into each other's eyes as though each was reading the other's inmost soul. "What was your mother's name?" Mr. Britton asked in low tones. "Patience, Patience Jewett," replied the other. Mr. Britton bowed his head with deep emotion, and father and son were clasped in each other's arms. When they had grown calm enough for speech, Mr. Britton's first words were of his wife. "What of your mother, my son? Was she living when you came west?" "Yes, but her health was delicate, and I'm fearful of the effects of my long absence. It must have been a terrible strain upon her. As soon as I reached the city this morning, I telegraphed an old schoolmate for tidings of her, and I'm expecting an answer any moment." They talked of the strange chain of circumstances which had brought them together and of the mysterious bond by which they had been so closely united while as yet unconscious of their relationship. The summons to lunch recalled them to the present. As they rose to leave the room, Mr. Britton threw his arms affectionately about Darrell's shoulders, exclaiming, "My son, mine, and I have loved you as much from the first time I looked into your eyes. If God will now only permit me to see my beloved wife again, I can ask nothing more." And as Darrell gazed at the noble form towering slightly above his own, and looked into the depths of those gray eyes, penetrating, fearless, yet tender as a woman's, he felt that however sweet and sacred had been the friendship between them in the past, it was as naught compared with the infinitely sweeter and holier relationship of father and son. They passed into the dining room where Mr. Underwood and Mrs. Dean awaited them, a look of eager expectancy on both faces, the wistful expression of Mrs. Dean as she watched for the first token of recognition on Darrell's part being almost pathetic. Mr. Britton, who had entered slightly in advance, paused halfway across the room and, placing his hand on Darrell's shoulder, said, in a voice which vibrated with emotion, "My dear friends, Mrs. Dean and Mr. Underwood, allow me to introduce my son, John Darrell Britton." There was a moment of strained silence in which only the labored breathing of Mr. Underwood could be heard.
"Do you mean that you have adopted him?" Mr. Underwood asked, slowly, seeming to speak with difficulty. "No, David, he is my own flesh and blood, my legitimate son. I will explain later."
Mrs. Dean and Darrell had clasped hands and were scanning each other's faces. "John, do you remember me?" she asked with trembling lips. Darrell bent his head and kissed her. "I do, Mrs. Dean," he replied. She smiled, at the same time wiping away a tear with the corner of her white apron.
"I don't think I could have borne it if you hadn't," she remarked, simply. Then, shaking hands with Mr. Britton, she added, "I congratulate you, Mr. Britton. I congratulate you both. If ever there were two who ought to be father and son, you are the two."
Mr. Underwood wrung Darrell's hand. "I congratulate you, boy, and I'm mighty glad to find you're not a stranger to us after all." Then, grasping his old-time partner's hand, he added, "Jack, you old fraud, you've always got the best of me on every bargain. But I forgive you this time. I wanted the boy myself, but you seem to have the best title, so there's no use trying to jump your claim." Lunch was just over as a messenger was announced, and a moment later a telegram was handed to Darrell. As he opened the missive, his fingers trembled, and Mr. Britton's face grew pale.
Darrell hastily read the contents, then met his father's anxious glance with a reassuring smile.
"She is living and in usual health, though my friends say she is much more delicate than when I left." "We must go to her at once, my boy," said Mr. Britton.
"How soon can you leave?"
"In a very few hours, father. When do you wish to start?" Mr. Britton consulted a timetable. "The eastbound express leaves at 10:30 tonight. Can we make that?"
"Sure," Darrell responded, with an enthusiasm new to his Western friends.
"You can't start too soon for me, and there isn't a train that travels fast enough to take me to that little mother of mine, especially with the good news that I have for her." Half an hour later, as he was hastily gathering together his possessions, he came suddenly upon a picture at sight of which he paused and then stood spellbound, all else for the time forgotten. It was a portrait of Kate Underwood, taken in a gown she had worn on that night of her first reception. It served as a connecting link between the past and the present. Gazing at it, he was able to understand how the young girl, whom he faintly remembered, had grown into the strong, sweet character delineated in the recorded story of his love. He was able to recall some of the scenes portrayed there. He recalled her as she stood that day on the divide, her head uncovered, her gleaming hair like a halo about her face, her eyes shining with a light that was not of earth. He kissed the picture reverently. "Sweet angel of my dream," he murmured, "come what may, you hold, and always will, a place in my heart which no other can ever take from you. I will lay your sweet face away, never again to be lifted from its hiding place until I can look upon it as the face of my betrothed." His trunk was packed, his preparations for departure nearly complete, when there came a gentle tap at his door, and Mrs. Dean entered.
"I was afraid," she said, speaking with some hesitation, "that you might think it strange if you did not see Catherine, and I wanted to explain that she is away. She went out of town to be gone for a few days. She will be very sorry when she returns to find that she has missed seeing you." "Thank you, Mrs. Dean," said Darrell slowly. "On some accounts I would have been very glad to meet Kate, but on the whole I think perhaps it's better as it is."
"I don't suppose you remember her except as you saw her when you first came," Mrs. Dean added wistfully. "I should like to have you see her as she is now. I think she has matured into a beautiful young woman."
"Yes, I remember her, Mrs. Dean. She is beautiful."
"Oh, do you? She will be glad to hear that," Mrs. Dean exclaimed with a happy smile. Darrell came nearer and took her hands within his own. "Will you give her a message from me, just as I give it to you? She will understand."
"Oh, yes, gladly. Tell her," said Darrell, and his voice trembled slightly, "tell her I will see her at the time appointed, and that I never forget."
End of chapter 29. Chapter 30 of At the Time Appointed. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Jules Harlech, Mississauga, Ontario, Canada. At the Time Appointed by A. Maynard Barber. Chapter 30. The evening train, as it was known, a local from the south, was approaching the little village of Ellisburg, winding its way over miles of rolling country dotted with farmhouses of snowy white. To the east, rough, rugged hills surmounted by a wall of forest, while far to the west could be seen the sandy beaches and blue waters of Lake Ontario. The arrival of this train formed one of the chief events in the daily life of the little town, and each summer evening found a group of from 20 to 50 of the village folks awaiting its incoming. To them it afforded a welcome break in the monotony of their lives, a fleeting glimpse of people and things from that vague world outside the horizon bounding their own. Amid the usual handful of passengers left at the station on this particular evening were two who immediately drew the attention of the crowd. Two men, one something over 50 years of age, tall with erect form and dark hair, well silvered, and with a grave, sweet face. The other, not more than 27, but with hair as white as snow, while his face wore an inscrutable look as though the dark, piercing eyes held within their depths secrets which the sphinx-like lips would not reveal. Closely following them was a splendid collie, trying in various ways to give expression to its delight at being released from the confinement of the baggage car. There was a sudden, swift movement in the crowd as a young man stepped quickly forward and grasped the younger of the two by the hand.
"Darrell, old boy, is this you?" he exclaimed. "Great Scott, what have you been doing to yourself these 2 years?"
"Plenty of time for explanation later," said Darrell, shaking hands heartily. "Ned, I want you to know my father. Father, this is my old chum, now Dr. Elliot." The young physician's face betrayed astonishment, but he shook hands with Mr. Britton with no remarks beyond the customary greeting. "Now, Ned," continued Darrell, "get us out of this mob as quickly as you can. I don't want to be recognized here." "Not much danger with that white pate of yours, but come this way. My carriage is waiting. I did not let out that you were coming back, for I thought you wouldn't want any demonstration from the crowd here. So I told no one but Father.
He's waiting for you in the carriage."
"You're as level-headed as ever," Darrell remarked. They reached the carriage, greetings were exchanged with Mr. Elliot, and soon the party was driving rapidly towards the village. "We will go at once to my office," Dr. Elliot remarked to Darrell, who was seated beside himself. "We can make arrangements there as to the best method of breaking this news to your mother." "You have told her nothing, then?" Darrell inquired. "No, life has so many uncertainties, and she has already suffered so much. You had a long journey before you. If anything had happened to detain you, it was better not to have her in suspense." "You were right," Darrell replied. "You know I left all that to your own judgment." "Darrell, old boy," said the doctor, inspecting his companion critically, "do satisfy my curiosity. Is that white hair genuine or a wig donned for the occasion?" "What reason could I have for any such masquerading?" Darrell demanded. "When you come to know my experience for the past 2 years, you will not wonder that my hair is white." "I beg your pardon, old fellow. I meant no offense. We had all given you up for dead, all but your mother, and your telegram nearly knocked me off my feet." Here the doctor drew rein, and, fastening the horses outside, they entered his office, a small one-story building standing close to the street in one corner of the great dooryard of his father's home, and sheltered alike from sun and storm by giant maples. After a brief consultation, it was decided that as Dr. Elliot and his father were frequent callers at the Jewett home, the entire party would drive out there, and in the probable event of not seeing Mrs. Britton, who was an invalid and retired at an early hour, Darrell and his father would spend the night at the old homestead, but their presence would not be known by the wife and mother until the following morning. "You see, sir," Dr. Elliot remarked to Mr. Britton, "your coming has complicated matters a little. I would not apprehend any danger from the meeting between Mrs. Britton and her son, for she has looked for his return every day. But I cannot say what might be the result of the shock her nervous system would sustain in meeting you. We are safe, however, in going out there this evening, for she always retires to her room before this time." Both Mr. Britton and Darrell grew silent as the old Jewett homestead came into view. It was a wide-spreading house of colonial build, snowy white with green shutters and overrun with climbing roses and honeysuckle vines. It stood back at a little distance from the street, and a broad walk under interlacing boughs of oak, elm, and maple led from the street to the lofty pillared veranda across its front. The full moon was rising opposite, its mellow light throwing every twig and flower into bold relief. Two figures could be seen seated within the veranda, and as the carriage stopped, Dr. Elliot remarked, "I was right. Mr. Jewett and his elder daughter are sitting outside, but Mrs. Britton has retired." As the four men alighted and proceeded up the walk towards the house, strangely varied emotions surged through the breasts of Darrell and his father. To one, this was his childhood home, the only home of which he had any distinct memory. To the other, it was the home to which long ago he had been welcomed as a friend, but from which he had been banished as a lover. But all reminiscent thoughts were suddenly put to flight. They had advanced only halfway up the walk when one of the long, old-fashioned windows upon the veranda was hastily thrown open, and a slender figure robed in a white dressing gown came with swift but tremulous steps down the walk to meet them, crying in glad accents, "Oh, my son, you have come, as I knew you would some day." Darrell sprang forward and caught his mother in his arms, and then, unable to speak, held her close to his breast, his tears falling on her upturned face,
while she caressed him and crooned fond words of endearment, as in the days when she had held him in her arms. Dr. Elliot and his father stood near, nonplussed, uncertain what to do or what course to take. The old gentleman on the veranda left his seat and took a few steps towards the group, as though to assist his daughter to the house. But Dr. Elliot motioned him to remain where he was. Mr. Britton, scarcely able to restrain his feelings, yet fearful of agitating his wife, had withdrawn slightly to one side, but unconsciously was standing so that the moonlight fell full across his face. At that instant, Mrs. Britton raised her head and, seeing the familiar faces of Dr. Elliot and his father, looked at the solitary figure as though to see who it might be. Their eyes met, his shining with the old-time love with which he had looked on her as she stood a bride on that summer evening, crowned with the sunset rays, only a thousandfold more tender. She gave a startled glance, then raised her arms to him with one shrill, sweet cry, the cry of the lone night bird for its mate. "John!" "Patience," came the responsive note, deep, resonant, tender. He held her folded within his arms until he suddenly felt the fragile form grow limp in his grasp. Then lifting her, he bore her tenderly up the walk, past the bewildered father and sister, into the house, Dr. Elliot leading the way, and laid her on the couch in her own room. She was soon restored to consciousness, and, though able to say little, lay feasting her eyes alternately upon the face of husband and son, her glance, however, returning oftener and dwelling longer on the face of the lover, who, after more than 27 years of absence, was a lover still. End of chapter 30. Chapter 31 of At the Time Appointed. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Jules Harlech of Mississauga, Ontario, Canada. At the Time Appointed by A. Maynard Barber. Chapter 31, An Eastern Home. Within a few days, Darrell and his father were domiciled in the Jewett homestead, the physicians pronouncing it unwise to attempt to remove Mrs. Britton to another home. To experienced Jewett, who reigned supreme in her father's house, it seemed as though two vandals had invaded her domain. So ruthlessly did they open up the rooms for years jealously guarded from sunshine and dust. While her cherished household gods were removed by sacrilegious hands from their time-honored niches and consigned to the ignominy of obscure back chambers or the oblivion of the garret. Under Mr. Britton's supervision, soon after his arrival, the great double parlors, which had not been used since the funeral of Mrs. Jewett some 7 years before, were thrown wide open. Sally, the help, standing with open mouth and arms akimbo, aghast at such proceedings, while Miss Jewett executed a lively quick step in pursuit of a moth, which, startled by the unusual light, was circling above her head. Not only were the gaily flowered Brussels carpet and the black haircloth furniture the same as when he had been a guest in those rooms nearly 30 years before, but each piece of furniture occupied the same position as then. He smiled as he noted the armchair by one of the front windows, to which he had been invariably assigned, and in which he had slipped and slid throughout each evening to the detriment of the crocheted tidy pinned upon its back. The vases and the candlesticks upon the mantel were arranged with the same mathematical precision. He could hardly detect only one change, which was that to the collection of family photographs framed and hanging above the mantel, there had been added a portrait of the late Mrs. Jewett. Within a week, the old furnishings had been relegated to other parts of the house, and modern upholstery had taken their places, the soft, subdued tints of which blended harmoniously, forming a general impression of warmth and light. Most of these innovations Miss Jewett viewed with disfavor, particularly the staining of the floors preparatory to laying down two Turkish rugs of exquisite coloring and design. "I don't see any use in being so skimping with the carpets," she remarked to Sally. "If I'd been in his place, I'd have got enough to cover the whole floor while I was about it, even if I'd bought something a little cheaper. A carpet with bare floor showing all round it puts me in mind of Dick's hatband that went part way round and stopped." "That's just what it does," Sally assented. "I wanted to lay down some strips of carpeting along the edges, but he wouldn't hear of it," Miss Jewett continued regretfully. "I suppose," Sally remarked sagely, "it's all on account of living out west along with them wild Injuns and cowboys so many years. Western folks most always has queer ideas about things. I never would have believed it to see such overturnings in my house," exclaimed Miss Jewett with a sigh, "and if it 'twas anybody but John Britton, I wouldn't stand it. I wonder if he won't be telling me how to make butter and raise chickens and turkeys next." "Maybe he'll bring round one of them newfangled contrivances for hatching chickens without ends," Sally ventured with a laugh, adding reflectively, "I wonder why, when they was about it, they didn't invent a machine to lay eggs as well as hatch 'em. That would have been a saving, for the hens' keep don't amount to much when she's settin', but they're powerful big eaters generally." Miss Jewett prided herself upon her thrift and economy. Her well-kept house, where nothing was allowed to go to waste, her spotless dairy rooms and rolls of golden butter, which never failed to bring a cent and a half more a pound than any other, her fine breeds of poultry, which annually carried off the blue ribbons at the county fair. She had achieved a local reputation of which she was quite proud. She would brook no interference in her management of household affairs, and, as she said, no one but John Britton would ever have been allowed to infringe upon her established rules and regulations. There had been a time when she had shared equally with her sister John Britton's attentions. It had been the only bit of romance in her life, but a lingering sweetness from it still remained in her heart through all the commonplace years that had followed, like the faint perfume from rose leaves, faded and shriveled, but cherished as sacred mementos. She had not blamed him for choosing her younger and more attractive sister, and she had secretly admired her sister for braving their father's displeasure to marry him, and now she was glad that he had returned, glad for his own sake that the imputations cast upon him by her father and others were refuted, for her sister's sake, that her last days should be so brightened and glorified, but deep within her heart, glad for her own sake, because it was good to look upon his face and hear his voice again. Sally's strident tones broke in upon her retrospection. "There's one thing, Miss Jewett, I guess you needn't be afeard they'll meddle with, and that's your cookin'. Mr. Darrell, he was tellin' me about the prices people had to pay for meals on them eatin' cars, diners he call 'em, and I told him there wasn't no victuals on earth worth any such price as that, and I up and asked him whether they was as good as the victuals he gets here, and he laughed and said there wasn't nobody could beat his Aunt Espy at cookin'." Miss Jewett's eyes brightened. "Bless the boy's heart," she exclaimed. "I'm glad they're going to be here for Thanksgiving. I'll see that they get such a dinner as they neither of them ever dreamed of." Darrell had won a warm place in her heart in his baby days with his earliest efforts to speak her name. Espy had been the result of his first attack on the formidable name of experience, and Aunt Espy she had been to him ever since. Her father, Hosea Jewett, was a hale, hearty man of upward of 70, hard and unyielding as the granite ledges cropping out along the hillsides of his farm, and with a face gnarled and weather-beaten as the oaks before his door. He was scrupulously honest, but exacting, relentless, unforgiving. He was not easily reconciled to the new order of things, but for his daughter's sake he held his peace. Then, too, though he never forgave John Britton for having married his daughter, yet John Britton, as a man whose wealth exceeded even his own, was an altogether different person from the ambitious but impecunious lover of 30 years before. He had never forgiven Darrell for being John Britton's son, but mingled with his long-cherished animosity was a secret pride in the splendid physical and intellectual manhood of this sole representative of his own line. Between the sisters there had been few points of resemblance. Patience Jewett had been of an ardent, emotional nature, passionately fond of music, a great reader, and with little taste for the household task in which her most practical sister delighted. Having a more delicate constitution, she had little share in the busy routine of farm life, but was allowed to follow her own inclinations. She was still absorbed in her music and studies when love found her, and the woman within her awoke at his call. After Darrell's birth, her health was seriously impaired. It seemed as though her faith in her husband, her belief that he would one day return, and her love for her son were the only ties holding soul and body together, and, with her natural religious tendencies, the spiritual nature developed at the expense of the physical. Since Darrell's strange disappearance, she had failed rapidly. With the return of her husband and son, she seemed temporarily to renew her hold on life, appearing stronger than for many months. For the first few days, much of her time was spent at her piano, singing with her husband the old songs of their early love, but oftenest a favorite of his, which she had sung during the years of his absence, and which Darrell had sung on that night at the Pines following his discovery of the violin, "Loyal to Love and Thee." Her delight in the rooms newly fitted up for her was unbounded, and against the background of their subdued warm tints she made a strikingly beautiful picture, with her sweet, spirituelle face crowned with waving silver hair. Either Darrell or his father or both were constantly with her, for they realized that the time was short in which to make amends for the missing years. She loved to listen to her husband's tales of the Great West, or to bits which Darrell read from his journal of that strange chapter of his own life. "You have not asked after your sweetheart, Darrell," his mother said one evening soon after his arrival, as they sat awaiting his father's return from a short stroll. "You are my sweetheart now, little mother," he replied, kissing the hand that lay within his own. "Does that mean that you care less for Marion than before you went away?" she queried. "No," Darrell answered slowly. "I cannot say that my regard for her has decreased. I may have changed in some respects, but not in my feelings towards Marion." "Do you think she still cares for me as before I left home?" "I hardly know how to answer you, because, as you know, Marion is so silent and secretive. I never could understand the girl. To be candid, Darrell, dear, I never could understand why you should care for her, and I never thought she cared for you as she ought." You know, Mother, how I came to be attracted to her in the first place? We were schoolmates, and you know she was an exceptionally brilliant girl, and different from most of the others. We were interested in the same subjects, and naturally there sprang up quite an intimacy between us. Then we corresponded while I was at college, and her letters were so bright and entertaining that my admiration for her increased. I thought her the most brilliant and the best girl every way in all my acquaintance,
and I think so still.
But, my dear boy, his mother exclaimed, admiration is not love. I don't believe you ever really loved her, and she always seemed to me to be all brains and no heart. One of those cold, silent natures incapable of loving. I think you are wrong there, Mother. Marion is silent, but I don't believe she is cold or incapable of loving. She may or may not be incapable of expressing it, but I believe she could love very deeply and sincerely were her love once awakened. You know she has taken up the study of medicine. Ned Elliott told me she had been studying with Dr. Parker for about a year. Dr. Parker tells me she is making remarkable progress. I don't doubt it, Mother. She will probably make a success of it. She is just the woman to do so. There never was any mention of love between you two, was there? Or any engagement? Darrell's mother asked, with some hesitation after a brief silence. None whatever, he replied, and then added with a smile, we considered ourselves in love at the time, at least I did, but as I look back now it seems a very platonic affair. But I thought I loved her, and I think she loved me.
You say, Darrell, that your regard for her is unchanged?
Yes, the same as ever.
But you do not think now that you love her or loved her then?
No, Mother, I do not and did not. Then, Darrell, my boy, someone else has taught you what love really is. For answer, Darrell bowed his head in assent over his mother's hand. For a few moments she silently stroked his hair as in his boyish days. Then she said in low tones, answer me one question, Darrell. Was she a good, pure woman? Darrell raised his head, his eyes looking straight into the searching dark eyes, so like his own. My little mother, he replied tenderly, don't think that your teachings all the past years or the lessons of your own sweet life were lost in those 2 years. Their influence lived even when memory had failed. He bent and kissed her, then added, she was scarcely more than a child, not so brilliant, perhaps, as Marion, but beautiful, good, and pure as the driven snow. Hearing his father's voice outside, Darrell rose and, picking up his journal, opened it at the story of his love and Kate's. Then, placing it upon a table beside his mother, he said, there, Mother, is the story of my dream love, as I call her. Read it, and if you should wish to know anything further regarding it, ask my father, for he knows all.
End of chapter 31. Chapter 32 of At the Time Appointed. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Jules Harlech of Mississauga, Ontario, Canada. At the Time Appointed by A. Maynard Barbour. Chapter 32. Marion Holmes. The following day, when Darrell entered his mother's rooms, he found her with his journal lying open before her. Looking up with a smile, she said, Darrell, my dear, I would like to meet your Kathy, but that can never be in this world. But you will meet her again, and when you do, give her a mother's love and blessings from me.
Then, laying her hand on his arm, she added, "I understand now your question regarding Marion. As I told you, it is difficult to judge anything about her real feelings. For the first year after you went away, she came often to see me and frequently inquired for tidings of you. But this last year she seemed different. She has come here less frequently and seldom referred to you, and appeared so engrossed in her studies. I concluded she had little thought or care for you. I may have misjudged her, but even were that so, and she did care for you still, you would not marry her now. Loving another as you do, would you?" Darrell smiled as he met his mother's eager, questioning gaze. "If I had won the love of a girl like Marion Holmes," he said, "I would do nothing that would seem like trifling with that love. But in justice to all parties concerned, herself in particular, I would never marry her without first giving her enough knowledge of the facts in the case that she would thoroughly understand the situation." His mother seemed satisfied. "Marion has brains, whether she has a heart or not," she replied with quiet emphasis, "and a girl of brains would never marry a man under such circumstances." Handing him his journal, she pointed with a smile to its inscription. "Until the daybreak," she quoted. "That has been my daily watchword all these years. Strange that you, too, should have chosen it as your own." Had Darrell gone to his aunt for a gauge of Marion Holmes's feelings towards himself, she could have informed him more correctly than his mother. She, with an old love hidden so deeply in her heart that no one ever suspected its existence, understood the silent, reticent girl far better than her emotional, demonstrative sister. A few days after moving into the rooms newly fitted up for her, Mrs. Britton gave what she termed a little housewarming, to which were invited a few old-time friends of her own and Mr. Britton's, together with some of Darrell's associates. Among the latter, Marion was, of course, included, but happening at the time to be out of town. She did not receive the invitation until 2 days afterwards. Meantime, Darrell, who was anxious to meet the syndicate from whom he had received his Western commissions 2 years before, left on the following day for New York City. Consequently, when Marion, upon her return, called on Mrs. Britton to explain her absence, Darrell was away. Marion Holmes was, as Mrs. Britton had said, a silent girl, not from any habitual self-repression, but from an inherent inability to express her deeper feelings. Hers was one of those dumb, speechless souls that, finding no means of communicating with others, unable to get in touch with those about them, go on their silent, lonely ways, no one dreaming of the depth of feeling or wealth of affection they really possess. The eldest child of a widowed mother in moderate circumstances, her life had been one of constant restriction and self-denial. Her association with Darrell marked a new epoch in the dreary years. For the first time within her memory, there was something each morning to which she could look forward with pleasant anticipation, something to look back upon with pleasure when the day was done. As their intimacy grew, her happiness increased, and when he returned from college with high honors, her joy was unbounded. Brought up in a home where there was little demonstration of affection, she did not look for it here. She loved and supposed herself loved in return, else how could there be such an affinity between them? The depth of her love for Darrell Britton, she herself did not know until his strange disappearance. Then she learned the place he had filled in her heart and life by the void that remained. As months passed without tidings of him, she lost hope. Unable to endure the blank monotony of her home life, she took up the study of medicine, partly to divert her mind and also as a means of future self-support, more remunerative than teaching. With the news of Darrell's return, hope sprang into new life, and it was with a wild, sweet joy which would not be stilled, pulsating through her heart, that she went to call on Mrs. Britton. She had a nature supersensitive, and as she entered Mrs. Britton's rooms, her heart sank and her whole soul recoiled as from a blow. With her limited means and her multiplicity of home duties, her outings had been confined to the small towns within a short distance of her native village. These rooms, in such marked contrast to everything to which she had been accustomed, were to her a revelation of something beyond her of which she had no conception, a revelation also that her comrade of bygone days had grown away from her, beyond even her reach or kin. Quietly, with a strange, benumbing pain, she noted every detail as she answered Mrs. Britton's inquiries. But conscious of the lack of affinity between herself and Darrell's mother, it seemed to her that the dark eyes regarding her so searchingly must read with what hopes she had come and how those hopes had died. She was glad Darrell was not at home. She could not have met him then and there, but so quiet were her words and manner, so like her usual demeanor, that Mrs. Britton said to herself, as Marion took leave, "I was right. She cares for Darrell only as a mere acquaintance." On her return, she entered the parlor of her own home and stood for some moments gazing silently about her. How shabby, how pitifully bare and meager and colorless, an emblem of her own life. Throwing herself upon the threadbare little sofa where she and Darrell had spent so many happy hours, reviewing their studies and talking of hopes and plans for the future, she burst into such bitter, passionate weeping as only natures like hers can know. Darrell's trip proved successful beyond his anticipation. He found the leading members of the syndicate, to whom he explained his 2 years' absence and into whose possession he gave the money entrusted to his keeping. So delighted were they to see him after having given him up for dead, and so pleased were they with his honesty and integrity that they tendered him his old position with them, offering to continue his salary from the date of his Western commission. This offer he promptly declined, declaring that he would undertake no commissions or enter into no business agreements during his mother's present state of health. He had taken with him the complete manuscript of his geological work, and this, through the influence of one or two members of the syndicate, he succeeded in placing with a publishing house making a specialty of scientific works. These facts, communicated to his parents, soon reached Miss Jewett, filling her with pride and delight that knew no bounds. Ellisburg had no daily paper, but it possessed a few individuals of the gentler sex, who, as advertising mediums, answered almost as well, and whom Miss Jewett included among her acquaintance. She suddenly remembered a number of calls which her household duties had hitherto prevented her returning, and decided that this was the most opportune time for paying them. Ordering her carriage and donning her best black silk gown, she proceeded with due ceremony to make her round of calls, judiciously dropping a few words here and there, which, like the seed sown on good ground, brought forth fruit 30, 60, and 100-fold. As a result, Darrell, upon his return, found himself a literary star of the first magnitude, the cynosure of all eyes. These reports reaching Marion only widened the gulf which she felt now intervened between herself and Darrell. Almost immediately upon his return, Darrell called upon her. She was at home, but sent a younger sister to admit him while she nerved herself for the dreaded interview. As he awaited her coming, he looked around him with a sort of wonder. Each object seemed familiar, and yet, was it possible this was the room that used to seem so bright and pleasant as he and Marin conned their lessons together? Had it changed, he wondered, or had he? Marion's entrance put a stop to his musings. He sprang to meet her. She advanced slowly. She had changed very little. Her face, unless animated, was always serious, determined. It was a shade more determined, almost stern, but it had the same strong intellectual look which had always distinguished it, and for which he had admired it. Darrell, on the contrary, was greatly changed. Marion, gazing at the snow-white hair, the dark eyes with their piercing, inscrutable look, the firmly set mouth, and noting the bearing of conscious strength and power, was unable to recognize her quondam schoolmate until he spoke. The voice and smile were the same as of old. They clasped hands for an instant, then Darrell, as in the old days, dropped easily into one corner of the little sofa, supposing she would take her accustomed place in the other corner. But instead, she drew a small rocker opposite and facing him, in which she seated herself. His manner was cordial and free, as, after a few inquiries regarding herself, he spoke of his absence, touching lightly upon his illness and its strange consequences, and expressed his joy at finding himself at home once more. She was kind and sympathetic, but her manner was constrained. She could not banish the remembrance of her call upon his mother, of the contrast between his home and hers, and as he talked, something indefinable in his language, in his very movements and gestures, revealed to her sensitive nature a contrast, a difference between them. He had somehow reached ground to which she could not attain. He drew her out to speak of her new studies and congratulated her upon her progress, but the call was not a success, socially or otherwise. When Darrell left the house, he believed more firmly than ever that Marion had loved him in the past. Whether she had ceased to love him, he could not then determine. Time would tell. During the weeks that followed, there were numerous gatherings of a social and informal nature where Darrell and Marion were thrown in each other's society. But, though he still showed preference for her over the girls of his acquaintance, she shrank from his attention, avoiding him whenever she could do so without causing remark. Thanksgiving Day came, and Miss Jewett's guests were compelled to admit that she had surpassed herself. The dinner was one long to be remembered. Her prize turkey occupied the place of honor, flanked on one side by roast duck, superbly browned, and on the other by an immense chicken pie, while savory vegetables, crisp pickles, and tempting relishes, such as she only could concoct, crowded the table in every direction. A huge plum pudding headed the second course, with an almost endless retinue of pies, mince, pumpkin, and apple, while golden custards and jellies, red, purple, and amber, of currant, grape, and peach, brought up the rear. A third course of fruits and nuts followed, but by that time scarcely anyone was able to do more than make a pretense of eating. To this dinner were invited the minister and his wife, one or two far-removed cousins, who usually put in an appearance at this season of the year. Marion Holmes and a decrepit old lady, a former friend of Mrs. Jewett's, who confided to the minister's wife that she had eaten a very light breakfast and no lunch whatever in order that she might be able to do justice to experience's dinner. Marion Holmes was not there, and Darrell, meeting her on the street the next day, playfully took her to task. "Why were you not at dinner yesterday?" he inquired. "Have you no more regard for my feelings than to leave me to be sandwiched between the parson's wife and old Mrs. Pettigrew?"
I might have gone had I known such a fate as that awaited you," she replied, laughing. "But," she added with some spirit, thinking it best to come to the point at once, "I can see no reason for thrusting myself into your family gatherings simply because you and I were good comrades in the past." "Were we not something more than merely good comrades, Marion?" he asked, anxious to ascertain her real feelings towards himself. "It seems to me we were, or at least that we thought we were." "That may be," she answered, her color rising slightly. "But if we thought so then, that is no reason for deceiving ourselves any longer." She intended to mislead him, and she did. "Very well," he replied, "we will not deceive ourselves. We will have a good understanding with ourselves and with each other. Is there any reason why we should not be at least good comrades now?" "I know of none," she answered, meeting his eyes without wavering. "Then let us act as such, and not like two silly children, afraid of each other." "Is that a compact?" he asked, smiling and extending his hand. "It is," she replied, smiling brightly in return as their hands clasped, thus by word and act renouncing her dearest hopes without his dreaming of the sacrifice. End of chapter 32. Chapter 33 of At the Time Appointed. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording done by Jules Harlech of Mississauga, Ontario, Canada. At the Time Appointed by A. Maynard Barbour. Chapter 33. Into the Fullness of Life. With the opening of cold weather, the seeming betterment in Mrs. Britton's health proved but temporary. As the winter advanced, she failed rapidly, until, unable to sit up, she lay on the low couch, wheeled from room to room, to afford all the rest and change possible. Day by day her pallor grew more and more like the waxen petals of the lily, while the fatal rose flush in her cheek deepened, and her eyes, unnaturally large and lustrous, had in them the look of those who dwell in the borderland. She realized her condition as fully as those about her, but there was neither fear nor regret in the eyes, which, fixed on the glory invisible to them, caught and reflected the light of the other world, till, in the last days, those watching her saw her face as it had been the face of an angel. No demonstration of sorrow marred the peace in which her soul dwelt the last days of its stay, for the very room seemed hallowed, a place too sacred for the intrusion of any personal grief. Turning one day to her husband, who seldom left her side, she said, "My sorrow made me selfish. I see it now. Look at the good you have done, the many you have helped. What have I done? What have I to show for all these years?" Just then, Darrell passed the window before which she was lying. "There is your work, Patience," Mr. Britton replied tenderly. "You have that to show for those years of loneliness and suffering. Surely, love, you have done noble work there, work whose results will last for years, probably for generations yet to come." Her face lighted with a rapturous smile. "I had not thought of that," she whispered. "I will not go empty-handed after all. Perhaps he will say of me as of one of old, 'She hath done what she could.'" From that time she sank rapidly, sleeping lightly, waking occasionally with that childlike smile, then lapsing again into unconsciousness. One evening, as the day was fading, she awoke from a long sleep
and looked intently into the faces gathered about her. Her pastor, who had known her through all the years of her sorrow, was beside her, bending over her and looking into the eyes now dimmed by the approaching shadows. He said, "You have not much longer to wait, my dear sister." With a significant gesture, she pointed to the fading light. "Until the daybreak," she murmured with difficulty. He was quick to catch her meaning and bowed his head in token that he understood. Then, raising his hand above her head, as though in benediction, in broken tones he slowly pronounced the words, "Thy sun shall no more go down, neither shall thy moon withdraw itself, for the Lord shall be thine everlasting light, and the days of thy mourning shall be ended." Her face brightened, a seraphic smile burst forth, irradiating every feature with a light which never faded, for, with a look of loving farewell into the faces of husband and son, she sank into a sleep from which she did not wake. And when, as the day was breaking over the eastern hilltops, her soul took flight, the smile still lingered, deepening into such perfect peace as is seldom seen on mortal faces. As Darrell, a few moments later, stood at the window, watching the stars paling one by one in the light of the coming dawn, a bit of verse with which he had been familiar years before, but which he had not recalled until then, recurred to him with a peculiar force. "A soul passed out on its way towards heaven as soon as the word of release was given, and the trail of the meteor swept round the lovely form of the homeward bound. Glimmering, shimmering, there on high, the stars grew dim as one passed them by, and the earth was never again so bright, for a soul had slipped from its place that night." After Mrs. Britton's death, deprived of her companionship and of the numberless little ministrations to her comfort in which they had delighted, both Mr. Britton and Darrell found life strangely empty. They also missed the strenuous Western life to which they had been accustomed, with its ceaseless demands upon both muscle and brain. The life around them seemed narrow and restricted. The very monotony of the landscape wearied them. They longed for the freedom and the activity of the West, the breadth and height of the mountains. As both were standing one day beside the resting place of the wife and mother, which Mr. Britton had himself chosen for her, the latter said, "John, there are no longer any ties to hold us here. You may have to remain here until affairs are settled, but I have no place, and want none, in Hosea Jewett's home. I'm going back to the West, and I know that sooner or later you will return also, for your heart is among the mountains. But before we separate, I want one promise from you, my son." "Name it," said Darrell. "You know, Father, I would fulfill any and every wish of yours within my power. It was my wish in the past, when my time should come to die, to be buried on the mountainside near the Hermitage. But life henceforth for me will be altogether different from what it has been heretofore. And I want your promise, John, if you outlive me, that when the end comes, no matter where I may be, you will bring me back to her, that when our souls are reunited, our bodies may rest together within sound of the river's voice and shielded by the overhanging boughs from winter's storm and summer's heat." Father and son clasped hands above the newly made grave. "I promise you, Father," Darrell replied, "but you did not need to ask the pledge." When John Britton left Ellisburg a few days later, a crowd of friends were gathered at the little depot to extend their sympathy and bid him farewell. A few were old associates of his own, some were his wife's friends, and some Darrell's. To those who had known him in the past, he was greatly changed, and none of them quite understood his quaint philosophizings, his broad views, or his seeming isolation from their workaday business world, in which he had formerly taken so active a part. They knew not of his years of solitary life, or of how lives spent in years of contemplation and reflection, of retrospection and introspection, became gradually lifted out of the ordinary channels of thought and out of touch with the more practical life of the world. But they had had abundant evidence of his love and devotion to his wife, and of his kindness and liberality towards many of their own number, and for these they loved him. There was not one, however, who mourned his departure so deeply as experienced Jewett. Though she gave little expression to her sorrow, she had hoped that after her sister's death his home would still be with them. This, not from any weak sentimentality or any thought that he would ever be aught than as a brother to her, but because his very presence in the home was refreshing, helpful, comforting, and because it was a joy to be near him, to hear him talk, and to minister to his comfort. But he was going from them, and she well knew, never to return, and beneath the brave, smiling face she carried a sore and aching heart. Thus John Britton bade the East farewell, and turned his face toward the great West, mindful only of the grave under the elms to which the river murmured night and day, and with no thought of return until he, too, should come to share that peaceful resting place. End of chapter 33.